Yes, you're wrong. The podcast where we talk trash about the things people love to hate and hate to love, and we're your hosts, Shelby and Matt.
I'm so sorry, Shelby. Could you get me a bowl of water, please? Oh. I'm so thirsty, and it's harder to drink out of cups.
Bite your lip. Your bottom lip.
Oh, I'm bleeding.
Just unhinged. There should be a body swap between Freakier Friday and Weapons. And that could be the next crossover.
I mean, there sort of were body swaps in both of those. We are bringing back the double feature.
A feature that we
might have more on the podcast now, because the big issue up until this point has been that one of us, I don't want to name names, has had a child and a job, but
I see.
Starting okay. Soon, the child will be in school, and she's not working, so you can just go see movies every day, and you know,
no need to choose, you know, why not have both? And
especially for you to come blazing back in the movie rankings at the end of the year, where like now all of a sudden you're seeing like triple the movies that I am, and you're like, you didn't see this? That's embarrassing.
Yes, I'll be living full time at the movie theater. It's like 9 a.m. showing, I'm there. 4 p.m. showing, why not? You know,
so true.
I think it'll be a great opportunity for this podcast to really blossom and thrive 8 years in. You know, this is us hitting our stride.
I'm having lots of thoughts, but I'm like, okay, also another plan that we should work out is wherever I am working, like sometime like in January, you should start like kind of sort of writing like occasional pieces for me as a freelance. And then next summer, you can also apply for a TIFF press pass. And then we can go to TIFF together.
Oh my God, what a dream. You don't get a plus one like just automatically? Okay, fine.
No, I don't.
I'll do some work.
You'd have to do minimal work.
Okay, I'll do my best. That would be fun.
Yeah,
that's a good motivator to like try.
We're in no hurry, you know, we've got time.
I love it, unfortunately
this year's TIFF the window has closed on
that's
that
fair.
One
so that's fair.
You're gonna have to wait a year, but before we get into the movies, we do need to talk about breaking news, unfortunately. Oh, for me.
Oh my God, what do you have for me, Matt? Like, honestly,
which
who
is
are you?
The life of a showgirl, Taylor Swift's upcoming album. Did we even know? We knew that she was like teasing something. Did we even know the title when we recorded
We didn't
know.
It was like, she's probably going to release an album and it's going to happen on her boyfriend's podcast.
Oh, yes. Because she was going on the podcast. Yeah. Yes.
And I think this all happened, like this all happened really rapid because there was a leak. And I didn't believe the leak because it seemed so like unhinged. Like, there was like a song title Wood, and I was like, this feels AI generated in a way, not because it, like, obviously she's had like, what is The Last Great American Dynasty, what is that title, you know? It's pretty easy to make up song titles and they either sound weird or they don't, but the leak was very like sexy. And I was like, you know, we've come on Folklore, Evermore, Midnight's
the torture. Are the songs leaked or just the tracks are leaked?
I don't think the songs are. I think the full, like it seems like someone got their hand on a physical album. Like, and I hear that she's pretty pissed about it. You know, she hates a leak, or her team is. And so they're like hunting down like who lost this, who got this somehow. But all of that to say that.
So do they have like the lyrics then?
Yeah, they have the lyrics. They have all the production credits. It's hard to find at this point.
Oh, okay.
But yeah, like, cause I saw it and I was like, this seems pretty out there. You know, cause it had the photos that ended up being in her carousel today when she posted about it.
Okay.
And I was like, oh my God, that's really like sexy for coming off of Tortured Poets Department, where she's wearing like a Victorian black gown, you know? But no, so it seems like this has all happened really fast, like where they didn't even wait until the podcast teaser Wednesday to announce the album. They released it that day. And then today they didn't wait until the podcast again to then release the full album cover and track list and whatnot. So it might have been sped up, you know, this might have all been sped up because of leaks, or she's just excited to do it. But we do not have a release date yet. But we know the song titles and that it's all produced by Max Martin and Shellback, who are her pop hit makers from 1989, Red, and Reputation. So that's exciting. And it's a short album. It seems very like high concept, like less maybe diaristic. She left the fountain pen at home and is just going back to her pop girly roots, and I'm excited about that. I think it'll be fun, I hope.
Well, Max Martin, I feel like, is a busy individual, so he does not have time to be like you know, like I feel like Jack Antonoff and Taylor could just like spend nine million years writing like, a 5 billion songs. Max Martin's like, you're getting 12. That's what you're getting.
That's true. That's
like fair. Like, this is your order? Okay, because then I got to be on to the next person.
Yeah.
I got to write And Juliet 2, you know, we got to do another musical.
I know, I'm curious. I'm like, I didn't read the lyrics. I don't know anything about it. I'm curious. I think this whole concept of Life of a Showgirl and the album art she chose is kind of, okay. It's definitely more poppy. It's definitely more in the 1989 visual-esque era than you did with the like moody Midnights or the farmland.
I think this cover is her worst album cover.
It's not great.
It's terrible. It's unfortunate. The colors are bad. The photo is weird. The font that she used is bizarre. Yeah. It's like, and also, I get if you want to do like a showgirl sort of vibe, but I don't understand what the water is involved, because as far as I know, there's not a lot of water showgirl acts. Like, that's not a combination that I see.
Do you know anything? Do you know?
Well, I saw the last showgirl starring Pamela Anderson, and there was no water in that movie. Yeah, just sort of odd, but again, like her aesthetics are bad. And so I think the more that, like, her personal aesthetics are bad. And I think the more famous that she gets and the less people helping her she has, sort of, the worse that they have gotten.
Well, the file I saw had the, like, last slide as the cover art, where she's in her, like, full showgirl get up and it's very sexy and, like, you know. I like that more. And so it is interesting to have this like teal color scheme she wants to force, because it does seem sort of out of place with the other photos in her.
Well, especially the orange of it all. Oh, I feel like the
it's
best
out October 3rd. Oh my God. That's perfect. Wow. Because October
Because it's
3rd,
pumpkin.
October 3rd is the day of the wedding in Freakier Friday. What are the odds? And the day of the wedding in Freakier Friday is the day from Mean Girls. So it's like, wow, October 3rd really is that bitch.
I really like the photo of her like with the martini glass or like the gimlet glass or whatever that is. I'm like, I feel like that would have been a better cover photo, although her foot is cut off, so it doesn't really work with the square, but you know, whatever. Like, I think that is the
it's
the
just
type
interesting
of thing that we're looking for.
I'm just curious to see, like, because the whole aesthetic doesn't really line up with this like pool teal. I don't know. Like, I don't.
Well,
I'm
also
fine with
the
font, whatever. But it's like kind of a weird cover. It's hard to
read. The font isn't showgirly font. You know what I mean? Like, it's sparkly, but it's not like it's.
How much showgirl experience do you have?
Well, I feel like showgirl is an aesthetic from like the early 1900s. You know what I mean? Like, okay, this is what I'll say. A lot of drag Race stuff. Like, a lot of drag queens on Drag Race do showgirl looks. So I'm very familiar with, like, those. And I feel like I've watched a decent number of movies that have involved showgirls, or, you know, seen, like, Chicago, like, I don't know, like, old-timey musicals that also involve a lot of, like, showgirl outfits. And I, when I think about showgirls, I think about, yeah, like, the sort of, like, not necessarily flappers, but, like, more in that kind of, like, aesthetic. Mm. And so I feel like the fact that she's basically just wearing, like, on the cover, she's wearing the showgirl, like, bra. Okay, great. But she's not wearing, like, a headpiece or feathers or anything. Then she's underwater. Confusing. Then the font is not, like, of that era. And then also, it's the weird, like ransom note sort of graffiti collage thing that she's got going on, which I also feel like doesn't fit. Like, there's just a lot of pieces of things going on here, and none of them feel cohesive. It's really confusing why she put these types of things together in my mind.
I guess she has four album covers she released on the podcast. I don't think you'll like any of them, but maybe you'll like them more. There's no water involved.
Have we seen the pictures of them?
Yeah. I just sent it to
you. Oh, wait. Now I'm seeing them on the on her Instagram.
Yeah.
Okay, number one, her climbing over a, like, theater seat.
Yeah.
Tits out.
Yeah.
The image on number two I like better. The, like, green one with the, with, like, the Roxy Hart wig. But, again, I hate the font. Number three, the sort of, like, weird nude illusion thing is strange to me. I like this, like, color palette better because everything sort of matches, but yeah. And then the green, but the green one I think is the worst of the four. Would you not agree?
I think.
Go on the record, Shelby, say it's bad.
No, I agree that when I first saw it, I was like, oh, I think looking at all four of these, it's not the font per se, but the size of it and kind of the kerning or whatever you'd call it, like the outline of it. I don't like how small it is, and I don't know how to explain it. I just feel like the scattered, like the.
And the it's line. All over the place. Yeah.
It's just kind of like, okay. So it's definitely not my favorite album of hers, but.
But, like, have you ever been in a work situation? Because this happens at our office all the time with, like, when we're doing, like, graphics for stories or our cover or whatever. Mm-hmm. Where someone is, like, makes a cover and then everybody comes over and you're like, oh, wait, no, this font is sort of weird. Like, let's put in, maybe let's shrink this image, whatever, you know? And it's like, it goes through a lot of people and it's a lot of like, oh, maybe changes. And it's always a little bit awkward if your boss likes one thing and you don't think that's the best. And it sort of then has to kind of become like a group effort on like, but actually like maybe this. And then if everyone else is like, yeah, but I think that's a really good idea, that second idea that's not the boss's idea, then sort of the boss's mind can change. But if it's sort of like half and half or whatever, then it's like, okay, you're doing what the boss wants, even if it looks bad. And I feel like, unfortunately for Taylor Swift, I don't know how many people are like, she's like, well, what if we put the words all over the place? And the graphic designer is like, that's so cool, Taylor. Like,
say, studying this, I think the layout of the first one is the best. And I wish the photo just wasn't, like, I wish she was either fully submerged or there was no water. Because I do think that layout of the text is the best.
Yes.
That's my final word on it.
I think I would agree with that.
I think it's just that her face being lined by the water, I'm just left kind of like, this looks kind of derpy, you know?
But it's like, not even like, her face needs to be like slightly more above the water, you know? It's like cutting her off in a weird place.
And it looks Photoshopped. Like, it looks fake.
Yes.
And which it might be.
Yeah, because her head doesn't really look like it goes with the body. Yeah.
But yeah, so I guess if it was like I have to buy a physical copy, I think I would still end up buying this teal and orange one for all my shit talk. So,
hmm.
Wow. Look at that.
Okay. Well, good to know.
But yeah, I do think it is interesting that it's like, it's not out till October 3rd. And she's had to release so much because she hates a leak moment. And now that there's these like lyrics and stuff, I wonder what she'll do. And she hasn't announced a single yet. So it's like, maybe that'll come out, you know, this week or whatever, but I don't know.
Yeah.
Curious. Like,
'cause if it's leaked, but the songs themselves are not leaked. It's just not that lyrics.
I haven't heard anyone say they've heard it. Like, I haven't mm-hmm. seen any whispers of like them listening to it. Maybe, mm-hmm. maybe it's out there. I mean, I'd assume it has to be, but yeah, I don't know. I think, and you know what? I'm excited because I do feel like this will be more like less autobiographical. I think it'll lean more into like the folklore writing element, where it's more like, even just thinking of her work with Max Martin and Shellback, it's not necessarily her most confessional storytelling. And yeah. So I like that this will be kind of a refresh, like a chapter closer on this poet's department style. Let's just air all our dirty laundry and do it in the most complicated and verbose way possible.
Yes.
And so I'm glad we're getting that like pop aesthetic, and then still maybe getting that that kind of more atmospheric or conceptual writing we got on like Folklore.
Also, if it's only 12 tracks, I sort of wonder if she would tour this or not. I mean, I'm sure that there is a longer version that will be coming at some point. But
yeah, the 3 a.m. edition featuring Jack Antonoff.
But it sort of feels like, okay, if this is like a smaller,
No, I bet she could tour it.
I mean, I think she could, but I'm like, I could see a situation where she's like, okay, I like need a break. I just did Eras Tour for 900 years. Like, maybe I don't need to do this. What I'm not looking forward to is a whole bunch of songs that are like, I'm a showgirl. Everybody is just using me. Like, I'm like, everybody's obsessed in there. You know, it's like, I just know that it's going to be like self-aggrandizing in like, I've been through so much. Like, I'm put on a stage. And you're
like, you know, she's being showy, like this is all exaggerated, like that's the theatrical part of it, then maybe you'd be able to enjoy it more, because it's like, it's all, it's theater, darling. It's just like, you don't have to take it so literally, you know.
No, if it was like, if it's like campy and like making fun, like poking fun at herself, then sure. But I do feel like there's going to be a couple like revenge-y kind of
did
things
you
in
like
here, because
did you like I Can Do It With a Broken Heart?
I honestly can't even remember that. I'm gonna go with no.
I'm so productive. It's an art.
I don't remember that song. I'm sorry to say.
It was like her only pop track on. Anyway,
was that off the last album?
Yeah.
That there was so many songs. I honestly don't know if I remember a single. Was the one where she's the giant walking through the village? Is that off the last album?
That's Anti-Hero.
What was the?
She's not walking through a village though. She's in her own house.
But she's like a giant.
She walks towards. Yeah. So the poet's department was You Liked Thank You Amy, if I remember correctly, which was the like.
Wait, but what was the big song? Because I have not heard this album since. Yes. Yeah. Was that the only big song off that?
Probably like Down Bad. Where she's singing about being abducted by aliens.
Not ringing
a
bell.
Or The Smallest Man Who Ever Lived, where you sent.
I remember that title.
Yeah. Who Wanted Me Dead. Did you sleep with a gun underneath your bed?
No.
Were you writing a book? Were you a super cell spy? In 50 years, will all this be declassified? And you'll confess why you did it. And you'll say, good riddance. Because it wasn't sexy once it wasn't forbidden. I would have died for your sins.
Are you saying this? Are you saying this off the top of your head, or did you pull up the lyrics to this?
No, I have this memorized.
Oh my god!
You deserve prison, but you'll never get time.
Okay, we have to move on. We have to move on. I'm losing brain cells.
You're such a hater. But no, I'm excited for this week. It definitely is an unhinged duo. Freakier Friday is obviously the sequel to I don't know, 2006 Freaky Friday, starring
2003 Freaky Friday.
2003. Oh my God, we're so old. Freaky Friday, starring Lindsay Lohan and Jamie Lee Curtis. And I had such low expectations for this film. I just want to set the stage right there because I was like, this seems like such a, like, you know, your usual money grab. Okay, we don't know what to do. Let's just throw them back together in this sort of like Disney-fied, like, this could have been a streamer.
It came out of nowhere.
Yeah. Like,
they were like, oh yeah, maybe we'll do this, and then the next week it was like, oh, here's photos from them on set.
Yeah.
Of like, how long did this woman have to work on the screenplay? Yeah.
But you know what, I actually really, really enjoyed it. Is that a hot take? I don't know. I don't think so.
I think people really liked it. I think it did well at the box office, and it has a 73% on Rotten Tomatoes, which I think is good. I thought this was good. I thought that there were some very obvious flaws with it.
Name one flaw, Matthew.
That's how much you like this?
Well, I guess what I mean is it felt like such a it just was so 2000s. And so I was like along for the ride. So I'm curious what you think is a large flaw. You mean just like logic storyboarding, or you mean like...
No, I think that the... So I wrote a review on this movie, which is up on the site. I think that the original concept for Freaky Friday and the original concept for a body swap movie, I think in the most part, is really straightforward. It's like you have character A and character B, and they're very different, and then you swap them, and then you get to see them in each other's bodies, and it's really like sort of exaggerated because they are different people. And it's really easy to sort of like, if there's only two of them, to sort of like see the dichotomy of that. With this, they add, it's four characters, so it's slightly more complicated, the like dynamics. And then I felt like all of the characters sort of had weird, like none of the characters were kind of extreme enough. Like they were more realistic, I guess, to real life. But I feel like with body swapping, it's like, okay, in the original, Lindsay Lohan is like a angsty rocker, and Jamie Lee Curtis is like a very put together psychiatrist. But in this one, Jamie Lee Curtis's character is like still a psychiatrist, but mostly just like a nice grandma. And Lindsay Lohan's character is like into the music business, but is also just like wants to be an attentive mom and like has a rocker past, but that isn't really out. And then the daughter is like kind of a rebel, but not, but her main character trait is just that she likes surfing. And I thought the most sort of like extreme character was the stepdaughter, who's like the British fashionista. And I think that that's kind of why Jamie Lee Curtis's character post-swap like got to do the most fun stuff, because her character was kind of the most extreme. Yeah. I felt like Lindsay Lohan and sort of both of the daughters like didn't get to do as much as I think that they could have if those characters had been like built out better. And then for the first half of the movie post swap, I was kind of like, what is going on here? Like all of this is sort of like a muddled mush. I think that the ending was so heartfelt and really like all came together well enough that I was like, okay, I liked this, but I sort of wish that there were parts of it that were punchier.
I thought they did a good job of making it zany, kooky without overly repeating like similar, you know, generational jokes from the first one, because it's like, yeah, it's pretty copy paste of you have a young kid in an old person's body, what are they going to say and complain about. But I liked that it was like, I really liked the Chad Michael Murray bit and them trying to seduce him, so that was like a whole fun
that scene they got to play with. That scene and was incredible, and all the Chad Michael Murray stuff was great.
And then like, as far as the girls, yeah, I guess I was laughing throughout. Like I was engaged. I was fully enjoying it, but I can see that like, okay, yeah, they were at school for a while. They weren't really like doing much.
And some of the jokes were like, oh, like they have to put on a lot of sunscreen before they go for a walk or whatever, yeah. Which I was kind of like, okay, like I get where this joke is coming from, but I'm not sure it's like necessarily quite landing in the same way. And then the same thing, I think, with like the fashion elements where it's like Jamie Lee Curtis is supposed to be like, oh, like now she's a fashionista. And I'm like, the outfits she's wearing are not giving fashion. They're also not giving Gen Z. Like they're giving sort of the friend from Wizards of Waverly Place energy, you know? Like that's what all of the like quote unquote fashion looks in this were giving.
I think the original outfits they walk down in, like when she tears her sleeves off, I think that was very Gen Z. And then she's wearing the weird sleeves. Like, but the baggy, like it's like, I mean, yeah, definitely it was giving messy.
Yeah. Like, I didn't hate the movie. I did enjoy it. But I feel like the original is, like, so sort of crisp.
Yeah, I mean, this ran long, but I liked some of the side bits. Like, Manny Jacinto was so hot and watching.
Oh, yeah, he was great. It was,
like, so fun. And so I was like, this whole dance sequence is funny. And like,
it sort of worked despite itself, but I wish that there, like, I think that there is a version of this movie that is better that I wanted.
I don't know. I was like having so much, like, it was funny. I don't know. Maybe it was because it's like, so, I mean, obviously it's like mother daughter centric, but on top of that, as someone who grew up with the original and, you know, focused on Lindsay Lohan's character, to now flip it, like, and to be the older person who, like, gets the jokes about why is my skin so dry, or like knees cracking and not being able to physically make yourself move because you're in such a, like, I don't know, like, it was like there was so much fun throughout that I was like, I was surprised. I was surprised that it was as sharp as it was, even though, yeah, it was probably pretty cluttered looking at it laid out. But I think, like you said, it all came together in such a sweet way that I was like, aww. Like, it was good. It did really well.
Yeah, like the side plots and stuff I thought worked. I loved Vanessa Bayer as fortune teller lady. Although I was sort of like, I...
Like the Starbucks. Like, yeah, I just...
Well, oh no, that was so funny. I was like... This is like a nitpick. This has nothing to do with why I didn't like the movie. But I am like, it's odd that in the original, we do the fortune cookie bit, which, like, sure, maybe that is like cultural appropriation in a weird way. Like, we don't want to bring that back. But then I thought it was odd to be like, oh, but the event is now catered by them. But the person who's actually sort of launching this, like, body swap thing is Vanessa Bayer's like Starbucks sidekick. I'm like, we should have just done the fortune cookies again.
No, I liked it because one, it was funny, and two, the fortune cookie bit would have been too obvious, and like they'd already learned their lesson that way, and so logically, why? Like, I mean, they could have made it funny, but I liked that the woman was like, I'm too busy for this, I have an empire, what do you mean? Of course I didn't do this. Like, I thought that was a nice way to kind of justify not going down the same route. And it also was just like reminiscent of like, what's her face? The fortune teller in Harry Potter, who's like bad at everything, but then one day gets one thing right.
Oh, yes.
And so I thought that was like fun, and that she was kind of unbothered that she actually did something. She was just so kooky that it was like, I think that's what I liked, is that I feel like movies are afraid to like kind of be messy, or they're like intentionally trying in a way. And this just hit the sweet spot where it was clear that there was like, you know, one writer. It wasn't a bunch of executives coming in with their needs and wants and whatever. And there's just like this passion project about making this just as fun as the first. And even the way it was directed, like really, really honing in on that kind of 2000s aesthetic with the, you know, reactions and the slow zooms and all this, you know, the concert footage and whatnot. And so I think it just like, there was clearly like a love behind the project, and they also had a blooper reel, and I'm just such a sucker for blooper
reel. Oh, I love the blooper reel. Wait, the best part of the movie was Chad Michael Murray.
Yeah.
I mean, not necessarily him, but like the scene with them at the record store was great.
Yeah.
And then the shot at the end where he brings his like new date to the wedding, and it's basically someone who's dressed and looks exactly like Jamie Lee Curtis in the first movie. Yeah. I was dying laughing out loud at that. I was like, this is the best joke in a movie this year. Like, so well executed. Yeah. Just genius. And you sort of like see her in a crowd shot or whatever at first, and I was kind of like, wait a second, is that? And then it's like, oh my gosh, like, yes.
Yeah. Well, and it like works because I think when a show's crazy, like, you kind of just like normalize it, or you move past it. But I liked that they like recognized how weirdly fucked up this kid would be after having like a crush on this mother figure and then falling for the daughter. Like, that is a weird situation in the first film. And so I liked that they played with that, and it surprised me. Like, I really didn't know. I thought he'd just be like the heartthrob type again, but him having this fixation on the grandmother was so funny and allowed his character to really like be zany in its own heartthrobby kind of way. Like, you know, because you think it's going to be Lindsay Lohan seducing him, and that's what they start out as, but then he like lights up when the grandma walks in, and that's golden. That was fun. And they both got to be super weird and awkward about it, which was also
I mean, Lindsay Lohan is such a star, and it's like every time I see her in anything, even those crappy Netflix movies, it's just like she's like, there's just something about her that's so electric. And that scene where she is like trying to seduce him but is doing it awkwardly is so good, and she just like throws herself into it in a way that I think is so funny. And it just reminds you of like what a talent she is. It's interesting, something that I have been, maybe I've talked about this before on the podcast, I had to do a list for work of like people who are in the four-timers club of SNL, like people who've hosted four times, who theoretically could be up for hosting a fifth. And there's really not that many of them. There's only sort of like four or five people. I think because SNL likes to have a member of the five-timers club like every year, they've sort of like worked their way through most of those people who are like, you know, have done it. And then you can clearly tell that there's some people who they're trying to like, okay, we need to bring him for a third time this time. So, you know, like that sort of energy. Mm-hmm. But Lindsay Lohan has hosted four times, and she's one of the few people who have. And I'm like, she's so funny when she's on SNL, and she's so game for it. Like, I need them to bring her back for something and have her host. And I'm like praying that it's the season premiere, because I'm like, Freaky Friday was so good. I feel like that would be such a great episode if they brought her back to host. So, like, that's what I'm rooting for.
Yeah. No, I think it was a good time. I think, like, I don't think it was flawless. I just think it was like perfect for what it wanted to be, which was sort of this like nostalgia driven vehicle to still have fun with.
Mm-hmm. Yes. My second option for hosting, though, would be Gladys from Weapons, because she is also an icon. Dear Aunt Gladys.
Weapons. This has been talked about. I mean, I'd heard about it, of course, from just like knowing movies coming out, but then the word of mouth really like built up over the last week as it kind of took audiences by surprise. And you know what's funny though is the director who, you know, directed Barbarian, I realized he is a YouTube guy from my childhood, and there was a skit that he did that has imprinted itself on me, and it's like so offensive to me now, but at the time, like, my 12-year-old self thought it was like peak comedy. He's the guy who did the grape you in the mouth skit.
Wait, he did the grapist?
Yeah, he did the grapist.
Wait, how did I not know that?
I don't know. I mean, yeah, I saw
it. How is that not on his Wikipedia page?
Because it's offensive. But when you see Weapons, it like makes sense that that's his comedy start. Like, that's his sense of humor is the grapist, which is like the whole premise is a guy pitching a commercial for grape juice. And it's a guy in a grape costume who ties people to his
Yes, no, there's a line. I'm gonna tie to the radiator and grape you in the mouth. Yeah, yes, so I say it all the time. Not all the time, but fairly often. And everyone's like, what?
Oh my God, Matt, how have we never talked about, like, I have such a, that's always, in, that's my Roman Empire probably is, I'm gonna grape you in the mouth. Like, it's just like lived rent free in my head.
Is that, like, can we, can you still watch The Grapist, or has that been taken down?
I don't know. I mean, I'm sure you can watch.
I'm looking up The Grapist.
But yeah, that's our great horror director of our generation. He got his start as a skit comedy guy on YouTube.
Wait. Oh, there's a version of it that was put up. I'm like, oh, but it's 4 months ago.
Yeah. Someone, he cleaned up shop, and yet the internet never forgets. But yeah, weapons. So Barbarian, similarly, was kind of this surprise hit horror comedy. And a very weird, like, literal basement movie. So people were curious about what this would be, which the premise is at 2:17 in the morning, an entire class of students, like, ran out of their house and disappeared, except for one. And so it's sort of the, that's how the movie opens, that's how the trailer's set up, and it's sort of like, why did this happen and where did they go? But it does a couple interesting things. One, where the narrative arc is like chapter by chapter from different POVs of these adults around this community. And two, it kind of turns into this sort of folklore fairy tale style witch hunt, like very reminiscent of sort of a Hansel Gretel, like nightmare, old school fairy tale sort of trope.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and I think one of the things that's interesting about this is, so I believe this was after Barbarian. He wrote this movie and was like pitching it around in Hollywood. And Jordan Peele's studio or his production company wanted to make it and bid in it and lost a bidding war. And Jordan Peele was so upset that he lost the bidding war for this that he fired his longtime managers.
Oh my gosh. Drama.
Yeah. So I'm like, once I heard that story, I was like, oh, okay. So there's clearly has to be something about this movie that, like, is working in a script level. I think another thing that's interesting is that this is a, it's like a Warner Brothers release. So it's like a big studio movie, but it's this sort of like weird horror movie. I mean, like, yes, it's from the filmmaker of Barbarian, but it, like, I don't know that Barbarian did that well that you would necessarily like green light something like this with such a big budget. So I think the fact that it, you know, sort of like came out of nowhere and was run by this big studio did put a lot of faith in the like script and how strong it was.
Yeah. 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 Cause I mean, we've seen a lot of sophomore efforts kind of like fail to live up to the original. Yeah. So how did you like this as Barbarian's number one fan?
I loved this. I thought it was great. I was on the edge of my seat. I didn't really know where it was going or what was happening. I thought that every time it switched points of view, it did it in a really like clever way that brought you just enough more of the story without like really like without revealing everything. And yeah, it was just, I was terrified at parts but so interested. There's so much like iconography of this movie that I think will stick in the cultural consciousness. You know, it's like the kids running, the like water bowl, Gladys, now of course the 7 hot dogs on the tray. Like, there's just yeah, I just feel like this is a movie that like is really like you can see a still from this in 10 years and be like, oh, that's Weapons. Because there's so much like specificness about this, or specificity, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah. I
you saw didn't it, really know anything going in except the like trailer.
No, I didn't know anything going in. I didn't see this at a press screening. I just saw it at a regular screening, and I was, and it was, I think it was like that, like the opening night, like Friday, the opening week, and there really wasn't like very many seats left. So I just like got a seat in between two people, which usually I hate doing, but like whatever. Mm-hmm. I like this was the time that worked for me. And I was like freaking out. The whole theater was freaking out. Yeah. And then afterwards, these two girls who were next to me were like, are you okay? You seemed like you really went through it in this movie. And the one girl was like, I thought about holding your hand at one point. And I was like, oh gosh.
That is so funny.
But yeah, no, I love this. And I thought all the performances were good and really like well put together. And yeah, when you finally get to Gladys and sort of like reveal what is actually happening, it's incredible. But then you still have like a half hour of the movie that I think still like really works in a suspenseful way. It's not like some horror movies where like once you know what the bad guy is, it like relieves all the pressure. It's like, no, this is still scary.
Yeah, she's freaky. Yeah, no, I famously have to kind of have an idea of what to expect in a horror movie before I'll sit down to watch. And I'd like randomly... because it was before it came out, but I was like hearing whispers of like, oh, this looks good. This is going to be so good. Oh my God. And so I looked it up and, you know, the screenplay had gotten leaked or released or whatever, because it's been a long time in the works. And so Reddit had this like thread talking about it. And I was like, what do you mean? There's a witch and there's sticks. And like, she controls kids. Like, this is weird. There's an AR-15 floating. Like, what? Okay. Okay. It just seems a little bit hooky, but like, whatever. But even knowing that, even going in, like knowing pretty much the plot, it was still very, very creepy, very scary and unsettling and nerve-wracking and gross. Like there's a lot of like shuddery images. And like I liked this more than Barbarian. One, because Barbarian has such like a kind of whiplash of tone, which I think works for what it's trying to do, but it was very like, oh, okay, now we're outside watching this weird dude run around town. Whereas this was like
felt less tense than Barbarian.
This felt less tense. That's crazy.
I thought so.
That's crazy.
Well, I feel like that first, or maybe it's not less tense so much as just like less realistic. I think that first sequence of the first chunk of Barbarian, where it's like the two of them and they're staying in the house together and you don't know who's bad and like what's going, like I felt so tense that entire time. I mean, I guess maybe it didn't work the same for you because you had read what was going to happen in the movie, but I was like, you don't, yeah, like you think he's the bad guy, then you're like, well, wait, maybe she's like, and then there's stuff going on, and then they have to go down in the basement and you're like, is he going to kill her in the basement? Like what? You have no idea that there's actually these crazy people under the house. Yeah. So you're constantly worried that Bill Skarsgård is going to kill her. And then it's like, oh no, wait, now there's this like insane, like woman, like bashing people's heads. And that,
Yeah. But I don't know. It's something maybe, you know, it's interesting what works and what works on people. Cause it was like, I get the most nervous in these sort of like real life situations. And yeah, the house is whatever, going to an Airbnb is real, but once you're in like a basement maze, I'm sort of like taken out of our present like reality. But like having so much of this movie be like slow pans down a suburban street or like kids in beds or you know, just walking to school, like it's just like, oh, like honestly the creepiest part was when she falls asleep in the car. And then
you hear and the woman cut their hair,
open the door, and you don't even see her climb in the car. Uh-huh. But it's just like, that is my greatest fear, is like someone being in my car.
and so then the hand comes up and you're like, what so is gross, she going to do?
So yeah. Well, but yeah, I think this movie was interesting and kind of, I mean, one, fun in its very specific sort of horror comedy way. Like he does a good job of knowing when to like release or acknowledge the tension. Like I think there were a lot of times where the characters were in these nightmare scenarios and they were like, what the fuck is happening? And that's like a big relief, because so often in these like horror movies, it's just like no one like admits how like no one admits how crazy it is. And so it was nice to like have this guy have this nightmare and he just immediately is like, what the fuck? And so, like, there's an instant, like, comedic relief where you're like, yeah, this is really weird. Like, what's going on? And then, yeah, things like the 7 hot dogs on a tray or the like husband shopping for him while he's on the phone. Like, it was like there were enough elements that the give and take of humor and horror really worked well in this. And I think it allowed us to expect the goofiness of Aunt Gladys when she finally appeared on our screens. Because otherwise, I think of something like Longlegs, where it's like this kind of kooky character, it either works or doesn't. Like, if you like that kind of shock and awe, you know, it was like a divisive film, whereas this Aunt Gladys made sense in the tone that had been set up through the first two thirds of the movie.
Uh-huh.
Because, yeah, so I don't know. What do you think the, like, message is? Everyone's talking about it. Do you think he just had an idea and he wanted to run with it? Do you think he was saying something about the kids are not all right? Like, what's your takeaway from the movie?
Well, when we got to the scene with the gun floating above the house, I was like, oh, this is going to be a school shooting metaphor. Yeah. I was like, oh, and that's why it's called Weapons. And people are going to go into it, think it's a horror movie, and then surprise, it's a school shooting metaphor. And then as I was going through, I was like, I don't know how that works here. So I'm assuming that's not what the plan was, because I am not getting the metaphor. I don't know. I kind of think that, like, we've had so many prestige horror movies where it's like, oh, it's horror, but it's about racism, or it's horror, it's about, you know, whatever the thing is. And I kind of think that this is maybe just like a horror movie for the sake of being a horror movie. Like, I think there are kind of morals you can take away from. Okay, well, what do you think it's about?
Here's my take. Okay, I think, one, you have these children who go through this trauma. They disappear, right? And so I think the movie is really focused on how adults, how we as grown-ups have reacted to and failed to kind of protect the children. And so having it jump from character to character of these really flawed, kind of failed adults, and how they're all kind of like fumbling the bag in different ways and kind of failing to appreciate their, you know, opportunities or their effect on the situation was an interesting way to kind of explore how, yeah, we just kind of like fuck things up. Like, we're not good at organizing. We're not good at really pulling together and like talking to each other or figuring things out. And we're so worried about how it looks or what we want or what we think, and keeping on, and like this sort of like normalizing or getting going or moving past without really processing type thing. So you have all these different characters playing into this part of like useless adults, and then at the end you have these children who have to kind of literally save themselves, and they do it in the most violent, like, horrific way possible. And instead of a usual horror film where we get to enjoy that like final fight and like they're victorious and it all works out and they're the final kids and they win, it's so happy, instead they're just like standing there traumatized forever, like forever changed. And I think that was what was so interesting in the frame narration, where it's like at the beginning this kid narrating is like, these kids disappeared and were never seen again, but in the end, you know, that's not true because all the kids are saved. But she admits, she's like, well, some of the kids are talking now finally. And it's like, oh, okay, so it's about how even in like a successful, like, oh, I survived this, let's say school shooting, or, oh, I'm like trying hard to like power through school drills or whatever, at the end of the day, you just have traumatized kids. And we can try and make ourselves feel better by like the dad rushing to his kid and saying like, oh, I got you, I saved you, I got you. Like this very self-centered belief that they did enough. But in actuality, that kid is forever traumatized and changed. And it's like pretty sad, the state of affairs and how we're just like, yeah, the kids are not all right. Like this is not, we have failed them in so many ways. And so I think that was what was interesting. Like that's what stuck with me, is sort of this like, that's why the AR-15 made sense to me. Not as like, this is about school shootings, but more as like, we are kind of weaponizing our kids as like, oh, the children are our future. Or, you know, this sort of idea that they can save themselves from the messes we've made. I don't know. I thought it was interesting.
Yeah, I feel like that kind of, like, I think that is a thing, like, I think you explained it really well, and I think that that, like, makes sense. I don't know if I necessarily think that, like, that was his intention entirely.
Like, the kids are fucked up, and, like, the parents back from it. Oh, my God. Like, it's just, like, brutal, the trauma. I mean,
I do feel like it does have a lot to do with trauma of, like, okay, yeah, you... I thought that the ending was really impactful, and I did think about school shootings and that kind of stuff in that scenario of, like, yeah, like, whether or not the kid gets saved, the child still has to, like, went through this. Yeah. And so, yeah, it's, like, the kids who survive a school shooting, like, are they fine? Like, yes. But I guess, like, the whole, like, witch part of it and, like, the fact that, oh, like, they didn't necessarily, like, weren't able to protect their kids from the witch in the first place, like, that I don't necessarily see as much of, like, a one-to-one connection.
Yeah. Not necessarily that they could have stopped the witch, but more that these grown-ups, like, I felt like it was interesting how the teacher, Justine, called the principal to call CPS because she didn't want to get involved because she had a pass, like, she had a record. And so there's this sort of, like, oh, well, it's your problem, or, like, guilting them. But then it's also, like, the cop who's sort of, like, unintentionally, you know, dealing with an addict who actually knows the truth type thing.
Yeah. I mean, all of the adults in this movie were bad.
Yeah.
And I do think that does maybe say something to the extent of, like, okay, yeah, like, we as adults, like, maybe individually are not terrible, although some of us are, but, like, as a society, we just, like, have dropped the ball on, like, oh, now we have AI and like pollution and all of these things that, like, we should have figured out, the next generation doesn't have to. I thought the craziest part about this movie, and the one part where I was like, okay, I think this is a problem, is when all of these children go missing. There is only one child in the class who is left not missing.
Yeah.
And he, all of a sudden, his parents have disappeared. Yeah. And this crazed, weird looking aunt is like, oh, they're sick.
Well, exactly.
And the police are like, that makes sense. Yeah. And they come and do, like, a half-ass house check. And they're like, oh, everything's fine. I'm like, no, you cannot tell me in the age of Netflix conspiracy like documentaries and true crime and true My Favorite Murder and all of that stuff, that nobody in a, like, national case where there are 17 children missing, that no internet sleuths are like, wait a second, the one kid who's left alive has a weird aunt who's, like, hanging out, has now started
shopping for buckets of poop every day,
and for months, and this has been going on for, like, months. I'm like, no, I'm sorry, I'm not buying that part of this. But I chose to sort of, like, look past that.
I mean,
when the cops came to the house, I was like,
then
she should have, like, put a spell on them or something. I'm like,
but I think that comes down to people, like, don't want to be bothered, like, even in this, like, yes, I agree. I think totally that's unrealistic, but I think it works in the frame of the story where it's like these people are,
I think if you were saying, oh yeah, like, these are the kids, like, these are, like, in a poverty school area, or like immigrant kids keep disappearing or whatever, sure. But like the 17 white kids in the classroom, like, I'm sorry, the cops are looking into that a little bit harder.
Right. No, for sure. I mean, ACAP, maybe that's what Ryan Kreger really thinks, is he's just like,
well, no, and I did, and I did, and I did think that. I was like, of course, like, the cops are so dumb that they can't even figure out that this crazy woman is the bad guy.
Yeah. Or at least, like, well, and what was also fascinating was this, like, small choice where the dad is obsessed with the footage, and then he realizes he could ask other parents for their footage. And I was like, why haven't they put this together yet? But then I liked that couple is like, oh, I've never watched this. Like, it's too traumatizing for me. And just, like, that nuance of, like, how people react to situations is so different. And, like, there's not one way, you know, it's not, everyone doesn't rally around like solving this. Some people are just like, bury your heads, move on.
But I too was like, okay, where are all these kids running? And then I was also like, well, yes, that as well. But the fact that I'm like, I've watched enough Criminal Minds to know, like, okay, we got to triangulate. Like, where all the, okay, the person probably lives somewhere in the middle. You know, they're going someplace.
Yeah, no, it was clearly a bad community to be a part of. Those cops were basically useless, and the adults were not thinking clearly.
Here's a potentially more interesting question to be asking. Why were the gay couple eating 7 hot dogs in
how many hot dogs between the two of them in like a hot dog eating situation?
1.
No way. 2 for sure. 2 for sure. Yeah.
No.
You have those, and those are small hot dogs. Those aren't like full toppings, brioche bun. Like, that is a simple
hot dog. You're eating 2 hot dogs?
Yes, 100%. You need 2 hot dogs.
That's insane.
That's crazy. That is like, if I'm going to a hot dog restaurant that has like, an entire bowl of chili on top of your hot dog, then yeah, you're only getting 1. But if you're just getting your little like grocery store dog with a little ketchup on one, then yeah, you're going to get 2 of those.
But if you go, but like they never, I've never been someplace where they serve hot dogs in pairs. It's not like if you order hot dogs from a street vendor, you don't get 2 hot dogs.
I'm not going to get, at a restaurant, I get 1. At home, I would eat 2 because they're smaller.
But, but if you go to a New York hot dog vendor that's like on the street, those are the same hot dogs that you're getting at home. It's not like they're bigger. They're just putting a little ketchup and mustard on there or whatever. They only give you 1.
They have to
like,
be
it's not like they sell them in pairs. No.
Yeah, because those are like small hot dogs on the tray. Is this a thing that a lot of people are getting stuck on or just you?
No, this is a whole meme on Twitter now, is that photo of like the tray that's like 7 hot dogs, chips, and cookies. And people are like, how are these 2 men eating 7 hot dogs? And then also is one of them getting 4 and the one's getting 3? Are they splitting the 7th hot dog? Like, what is the situation? And then also I do feel like, and maybe this is just me, but I'm like, a hot dog is a communal food. I have never in my life cook and eat a hot dog on my own in my house. Like,
that's just because you're not a hot dog person then.
Like, I mean, I guess so. I eat like 1 hot dog a year.
Oh, really?
We had hot dogs and hamburgers, I guess, like growing up on the grill growing up, like my family. But again, I think that's sort of like a communal thing.
Hot dogs.
Oh gosh, no. Not a boiled hot dog. Yeah, I'd rather die. Relish.
Yeah.
Okay, so clearly Mormons have a weird thing with hot dogs. That's what I'm learning.
I mean, that whole sequence was so unsettling and unfortunate because you have this guy who's like clear that this is a boundary that shouldn't be crossed. Like, he shouldn't let this student's parent figure come into his house. But then you have the nice boyfriend / husband, partner, whatever, who's like, no, come in, get water. And then the bit escalates where it's like, no, I want it in a bowl. And it's like sort of this, I just watched Speak No Evil and I'm just like fascinated by the way we are like allergic to offending people, or we're really hesitant to like trust our discomfort as some warning rather than just our own neuroses. And so that was like so sad.
I think about that all the time in the context of the girl with the dragon tattoo, because there's a scene where like Daniel Craig like goes to the house the bad guy lives in, and the bad guy sort of like invites him in, and Daniel Craig Daniel Craig like knows that he's the bad guy. And sort of like still feels like awkward about not saying like whatever. And then of course things go badly and Daniel Craig gets locked up and whatever. And Stellan Skarsgård has this whole monologue that's like, this is the problem. Like, this is why it's so easy to be a serial killer, because like people are afraid of like not being polite. Like, you came here, you knew that I was killing these people, and yet you still came into my house because you felt worse about possibly offending me and telling me, no, I won't come in, than potentially dying. And so I think about that regularly, and I'm like, if this came for me, I am like, I am not going to any creepy houses. I'm not going weird places.
You're not gonna be like, oh my god, slay, love your makeup.
No, if some weird woman showed up to my house, I would, and asked me for a bowl of water, I would not be giving it to her.
I think as a horror film, like, on its own, this worked. It was very creepy, very unsettling. I think the action moved along well. I think, if you're questioning the mechanics of it, like, you could be like, why is she doing this? What is she getting from this? Blah, blah, blah. How did she get away with this? What?
Like, she uses the kids to stay alive?
Yeah, I think it's like some sort of stealing their life force type thing.
Okay. So she's just like keeping them in the basement, like batteries or whatever. Yeah, exactly. And then when she needs one, it's like, okay, let's bring up.
But it's also like unclear, like, is she really this mom's aunt, or is it like she pretended to be? Like, is it an orphan situation, like, where she's like lying about who she is, or has this witch just been in the family and no one caught on to it?
Well, clearly it seems like the dad like had heard of her before. It doesn't really seem like, oh, we'd never heard of this witch. So I think that she was involved in the family. Now, was she like, did she sort of insert herself in the past and then now it's like coming to take them over? I don't know.
I know, it's kind of like, oh, okay. And then it's like, was it just a fairy tale, like, was it just a metaphor, but she's like the parasite? But then it's like, you know, were the parents wrong for letting her in, you know, that sort of thing. And it's like, okay, was this all intentional, or was it just a good horror setup? And that's, yeah, I mean, like you said, prestigious horror is always going to, like, it either works or it doesn't. And the important thing is that it works without caring about the, you know, larger message. And I think generally this one does. And clearly a lot of people agree. I think it's doing really well. And just, again, further proof that studios do need to invest in these sort of original concept, big swing moments. Because that's what's fun about going to the movies, is this communal moment of like all of us cringing when the addict sees Gladys waving at him in the woods and then runs into his tent and hears footsteps coming. And it's like, this was just like a fun movie to go see. And I think Sinners was another good example of that this year. And it's just like, I just don't get why studios don't understand that we like to be surprised, no matter how wild a concept it is.
I'm like, if the writing is good, then like the writing is good, you know?
Yeah.
Like, I feel like people need to be doing more of like, is the script great? Awesome. Like, Warner Brothers has enough marketing abilities that like they can get something like Weapons, which does not have, you know, a lot of big names attached or whatever. Yeah. A lot of people to go see it on opening weekend, and they know it's good, and they know that it will back it up. And I think the same thing happened with Sinners. The same thing happened with, you know, I think to a lesser degree with like Barbarian, with Hereditary, with Midsommar. Yeah. Like, you can do that. And I just don't know why movies are not doing that as often.
Like, if you need seven writers to come up with Anyone But You, then you know it's not going to be a good movie. So why are we wasting our time?
Or just sort of be like, okay, you know, sure, somebody wants to write a script for Freakier Friday, awesome. Like, write scripts about whatever you want. We're going to look at them all. And sure, if the sequel to whatever has a great script, perfect. We'll green light that. If it doesn't, let's try again. We'll green light whatever's the best script out of the group. Like, I feel like that's the way that, I mean, there's some things where you just know it's a cash grab. And I do think that it's nice to have those, because then that can sort of like balance out things that are maybe a little bit more risky. But I do think we should have more things that proves
that it can be an easy win, but still, like, if you have people who are enthusiastic about writing it and directing it, then it works.
Right. And the same with The Goldfinch. Like, that's another good example of.
Absolutely not. How many writers were on that? It was terrible.
Well, and how much money did it make? $3.
Yeah.
Which did you like better, Weapons or Freakier Friday?
I mean, just enjoyable experience, Freakier Friday.
Okay.
Well, yeah, I think it'll be interesting end of year to see. Like, I think Weapons will have more of an impact and, like, has more of that, like, artistic angle that might pass Freakier Friday in my roundup. But, yeah, and I think it's like, my sister was like, well, which one should I see? And I was like, I cannot answer that question for you. They're so vastly different. Yeah. It's like, what experience
do you want? That's a vibe question. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I will say I think Weapons was fun to see in theaters. Like, I think having that crowd experience is always better with horror because it's like there's something relieving about being in a room of people feeling the same thing. And even those girls next to you are probably grateful that your over panic allowed them to really relax about how panicked they felt.
Yes. Right. And that was my point. That's what I tried to do.
Yeah. You're just exaggerating it up, you know?
Oh, no.
No, don't open the door, Julia.
Is that Gladys?
Oh, my God. Yeah. And pretty gnarly death. Okay. Pretty disgusting. I did not look at the screen for that entire, deconstruction.
Oh, you didn't look at the scene where they ripped her jaw in half?
So gross.
That was a great moment.
Yeah.
Do you think, how many pennies do you think would it take to rip somebody's jaw in half?
No, that was what was sad too, is the whole like final chapter with the kid. I was like, this is so sad to think about. It's like, clearly, you know, I don't believe in witches. I don't believe this is realistic. But I was like, oh, that poor kid. He just wants to protect his spirit.
If Laura ever shows up to your house and asks for a bowl of water,
I'll be like, totally sus.
You know, weird aunt. Here she is.
Yeah.
Next thing you know, you're stabbing yourself with a fork. Which, I'm sorry, that also did not look very realistic. Like, when I saw the fork marks in the face, I was like, I think this would be, like, bloodier. I don't think this would just be, like, little marks. But
that's interesting. I don't know, like, the amount of blood flow. You know, different cuts bleed more than other things.
Yeah, and I've never stabbed myself in the face with a dinner fork.
We'll try it.
Yeah. I thought about doing Gladys for Halloween. I was like, that'll be a great Halloween costume. Unfortunately, I already have a Halloween costume planned for this year. So
yeah, why wouldn't you? It's already August, so
yeah,
I would expect no less.
But yes, these were good times in the movies.
Yeah, double feature.
Next week we have, I think it's going to be a little bit trickier to find something, but you know, we'll make our best effort. And yeah, thanks everybody for listening. Bye.